Our final speaker tonight is Cindy Milstein. Cindy's a faculty member at the Institute for Social Ecology and a board member at the Institute for Anarchist Studies. She's involved in organizing work in Vermont, where she's part of the Free Society Collective, and she also writes for various anti-authoritarian periodicals.
I want to thank the organizers for this also, and I'm very humbled to be the last speaker after all that, so I can wrap this up a little. But I really enjoyed listening to everybody else. I first want to say that I want to sort of talk more generally about the anti-war movement, and my view may be sort of warped or damaged by the fact that I'm an American or live in America, and I'm also live in Vermont, which is sort of like America and not America, but also a very small place. So I'm sort of speaking from those points of view. First, I sort of wanted to just talk very generally about the anti-war movement, sort of in the light or the shadow, depending on how you look at it, of the anti-globalization and especially the anti-capitalist movement or movements, because it's multiple movements when we understand that globally. And sort of broadly, it seems to me there's sort of three ways to view the anti-war movement that we just experienced, which had unfortunately also died down in the sort of time after the end of the war or the occupation of Iraq. The first way to sort of understand the anti-war movement is that it is coming in the wake or really the death of the anti-capitalist, that the anti-war movement is coming in the wake or the death of the anti-capitalist movement after September 11th. That after September 11th, the movement that kind of rose up specifically in North America after Seattle, peaked in places like Quebec City and other Canadian cities especially, was sort of put to an end or largely decreased after September 11th. And this current anti-war movement is thus different and separate. And in a sense, that kind of outlook made a lot of space for liberal pacifistic groups and also especially the anti-authoritarian left to basically come in and take charge, and I really do mean take charge of the anti-war movement, as if sort of there had never really been an anti-capitalist movement organized around anti-authoritarian lines, and as if somehow they were two distinct moments. I don't see it that way, but in a way I think anarchists to some degree allowed that viewpoint to sort of proliferate by not in a sense taking on sort of that separation that seemed to occur between the two movements. Another way to sort of understand the anti-war movement is to look at it as informed by or influenced by the anti-capitalist movement that had preceded it or actually still is around, and if not directly part of it, was indirectly influenced by it. That in other words, it wasn't necessarily the anti-capitalist movement anymore, but it was largely picking up on similar tendencies or themes that had come up in the anti-capitalist movement before that. If it wasn't seen as directly anarchist, it was very influenced by practices that had come up in the anti-capitalist and specifically anarchist part of the anti-globalization movement. And this to me seems like a more credible view of what happened, that people, in a sense, didn't forget what had happened with the anti-capitalist movement, which introduced different, especially forms of organizing, different ways of understanding how to put together demonstrations and how to work with people not in coalitions that sort of unify people around the least common denominator, but allow people to come together very openly around sort of root causes and maintain the diversity of their perspectives. And much as the anti-authoritarian left especially and liberals sort of try to corral the anti-war movement, I think things like February 15th, specifically in New York City, showed the power that the anti-capitalist movement had in terms of raising the desire for people wanting to self-organize and organize in different ways, much more at the grassroots. I use February 15th as an example because in the United States, both groups like ANSWER, very authoritarian, and pretty despicable Marxist-Leninist groups had organized some of the major demonstrations. In New York City with February 15th, it was very much of a liberal coalition trying to pull it together. But when they couldn't get the necessary permits and when the police kept kept shutting them down. That sort of people, there had been a desire raised, I think, by the anti-capitalist movement, that people weren't willing to sort of wait for permission anymore to do things in the streets. And there was a lot of self-organization that occurred, not just in New York City, but I'm pointing to New York City just because I'm sort of speaking from a North American perspective. And I thought that was a phenomenal example of when people are sort of told, just wait, don't worry, we'll get a permit. People weren't willing to do that anymore, which I think prior to the anti-capitalist movement they might have been willing to do. And people self-organized into all sorts of autonomous groups that coordinated with each other via the web largely, but also through phones and email and other things, creating all sorts of hundreds of groups that had agreed to meet at all different places all over New York City to feed together into one giant, basically illegal takeover of the streets. And most of those people weren't anarchists. I think anti-capitalists and anarchists had raised the desire for those forms of organization. And we could have seen that all over the world that same day. But a third way to sort of understand the anti-war movement was that it really was truly a part and a continuation of, and indeed should be, an anti-capitalist movement, not really an anti-war movement. And the whole anti-war sort of label was really a mislabel of what was going on. This is really a continuation of the same phenomena that many of us had already been opposing through the anti-capitalist and the anti-globalization movements. And I think that's where many anarchists situated themselves, to try to, in a sense, continue on the movement that movements they had been involved with before. And sort of the problematic with that was that for many anarchists, that in a sense kept them doing the work they had been doing and, in a sense, made anarchism less visible in the anti-war movement and allowed some of the authoritarian Marxist groups, in a sense, to sort of take charge, or the liberals. So, I actually do think that this should be a continuation of the anti-war movement. It should really be looked at as an anti-capitalist movement. And to me, one of the failures, in a way, what I want to kind of look at for the next 5 minutes before I'm supposed to wrap up, is in a way what happens, I think, during the anti-war movement is you had probably in human history one of the greatest outpourings of people all around the world saying no to something, but it still happened, which is a really strange phenomenon. And in a way, the work we do as anarchists or anti-capitalists, I think we have to ask, how did we fail? In what ways did we fail? Now, in a sense, the whole anti-war movement should be asking that question, but since we're anarchists at an anarchist book fair, I want to sort of look at some of the things that this sort of brought up for me as an anarchist in terms of perhaps ways we had sort of failed to make the connection between anti-capitalism and anti-war and show that it was something large and a continuation of the work we've been doing before. And I want to just talk about three things, although there's many other sort of critiques that could be made of sort of why, in a sense, there was this huge outpouring of resistance and then suddenly, almost overnight, almost nothing in terms of an anti-war movement. One is, I think this points to the limitations of anarchist forms of organizing and infrastructure. On the one hand, I think they are the most compelling forms of organization, organizing non-hierarchically, directly democratically, federating with each other, where everybody gets to participate in making the decisions that shape their lives, to me is the most freeing form of organization we could possibly imagine. But on the other hand, I think anarchists, while we raise the desire for those forms of organization, people don't know where to go to find them. During the anti-war movement in Vermont, I'll use it as an example, there was one of the largest demonstrations in the history of Vermont, which is a small state, so it wasn't a very big demonstration by other standards, but for Vermont it was. And at this demonstration, which was largely organized by liberals and the authoritarian left, a group of anti-capitalists decided to do a breakaway march, and about a third of the people broke away with us, and we had 1,000 or more people in a breakaway march. And afterwards, so many people were excited by it. They're like, I want to form a collective. I want to be part of a spokes council. I want to do more work afterward. But that we didn't have any infrastructure in Vermont, much less in that community, for people to plug into. Whereas the International Socialist Organization, which is quite large in that city, was right there with their newspapers and their organization and how to join. And in a way, this pointed to me that anarchists, in a sense, raise people's desires, and sure, people can self-organize, and that is the anarchist dream, that everyone will figure out how to self-organize. But I think it also, if we raise the desire, we have to be there to at least provide some forms of skill sharing. We have as much to learn about organization from other people, too, so we have to be willing to learn those skills ourselves. But we have to create decentralized, directly democratic, and federated forms that people can plug into and share our skills, and not just raise desires, I think, in demonstrations that there's no way for people to follow through afterward, and which limits the ability of us to maintain an anti-capitalist movement. The second thing is, I think that it also points to, there's sort of a truism that truth is the first casualty of war, but I also think language has been the casualty in this war as well. But I think we've fallen into that too. We were too easy to take on sort of the same rhetoric that people have used, including being willing to say that we are part of an anti-war movement or organize day after demonstrations. And as everyone has said here very eloquently, most of us recognize that this war didn't start on a specific day and hasn't ended and has a many, many, many decades history. It is something that's ongoing that happens somewhere else but also here at home. And in a sense, we made the same mistakes of taking on the language that was problematic. But more problematic than that, I think, was that while anarchists have pretty much always throughout their history been against war and militarism, war looks very different now. And I think anarchists have failed to spend as much time as, especially Marxists and especially Marxist academics, as trying to understand the changing world we live in, to be able to explain it to ourselves and to be explaining it to other people in order to know what it is we're fighting against and what it is we're fighting for. So, for instance, for me right now, war might look very different than it looked even 10 years ago with a previous Gulf War. For me, a lot of what happened in Iraq was not even a war so much as a large-scale police action where you get military as police doing a raid on a country to take over a country, which is a very different phenomenon. It's very quick. We're done. We've got the country. And in a sense, the war that is going on still, but in a different way, and we don't know how to respond, in a sense, to wars like that. We're still sort of in a different framework of understanding what wars look like. In a way, I also think with this war, some other things I was just that I think we have failed to understand is, and it's harder for us to deal with, is why things have sort of died down now, is in a way we're used to things like the United States going in to squash liberation movements. And in this case, they claim they are going in order to liberate people. And to some degree, they are trying to liberate people, but not for what we understand liberation to be a project of. It's in a sense to liberate people into the free market, into free trade, into the marketplace, to open up space for further commodification, to bring people into the sphere of the value system that we understand as free trade. In a sense, this is why I think it's contiguous with an anti-capitalist movement, is because in a way what the project here is, George Bush is very clear about saying, I actually think we should take him seriously, he often says exactly what he's doing, that they're bringing freedom to Iraq in the form of free trade. Just last week he was talking about the roadmap to peace in the Middle East as being, well, great, you take on the roadmap, you get to be a free trade zone like other parts of the world. In a way, I think we need to understand what this war is being fought for that's different than it would have been fought for 40 years ago or 100 years ago, that every time something happens, it doesn't look exactly the same. We may be opening up the Middle East, for instance, for oil, but I think we're also opening it up for the flow of information, for the flow of trade, for the flow of communication. I don't think it was any coincidence the U.S. government, for instance, allowed museums and libraries and television stations to be destroyed, because in a way what they want to do is come in and control culture and control the flow of information. So we need to understand the new world to be able to explain it as anarchists, not simply so we can be the next generation of academics to be able to describe the world for no purpose, but in order to be able to clearly show why it is that war relates to capitalism, that relates to free trade, and what capitalism looks like right now, and how we're going to fight it, which leads me to my last point. If we don't understand what's happening with capitalism, which I think more and more is both similar to what's always happened with capitalism, but different as well, then how do we develop a long-term strategy to dismantle capitalism, and what would replace it? So the third thing, for me, seemed like a failing, is a failing to strategize about what a long-term strategy would be for dismantling capitalism. We are very good, the world was very good this time at saying no to war, but I don't think most people know what to say yes to and how to get there. I'm pretty amazed that the number of people in the billions could have said no to war and it still could happen. It boggles my mind, if that can happen, how we could ever dismantle capitalism. So in a way, we need to think about what our strategies are to get from here to there more than we have in the past. Okay. I want to end sort of on looking at sort of some of the failures, but I want to end on a sort of positive note. In a way, I've been feeling very discouraged because of the downward spiral after this war, which is pretty much what happened after the last Gulf War. But I think it's very different this time, because prior to the onset of an anti-war movement, there really was a very visible anarchist movement, and there still is. There was a very visible anti-capitalist movement, and there still is. And that continuity has meant that there's still something to come to after the anti-war movement dies out, which is, after the last Gulf War, there wasn't. There wasn't really much preceding it, and there was nothing after it. So this time, I think we got more of a running start in terms of what resistance can look like. I also think the success of anarchists during this anti-war movement has been less at organizing national and global demonstrations than at doing good, solid work at the grassroots to bring people material needs, to dialogue with people, to learn themselves, to regroup. A lot more anarchist federations are forming, anarchist collectives, and the hard work of working at home, I think, has a lot of anarchists have moved to the grassroots, which I think is a good thing, but it becomes sort of invisible to sort of our mainstream media eyes. But I think we all know where we live, we're doing a lot more work at the grassroots. And the last thing I want to end with is, I think what's been most amazing about the anti-war movement, because the anti-capitalist movement really gave it an inspiration to organize in a different way, was it really showed the possibility that people can self-organize in solidarity with each other, voluntarily, around an ethical concern globally, over and over again on the same days, around the same issues. And it points to the possibility that we could organize the world that way. It really gives us a sense that that's possible. Whenever people say, well, anarchism won't work, I think all we have to do is to point to the inklings, the beginnings of what happened with this anti-war movement, is to show the tremendous level of cooperation and mutual aid and solidarity that went on in a lot of the demonstrations that happened to it, which is really unprecedented. And it shows a different form of globalization that can come out of this. So now, in a sense, we need to do the work of showing how that has to be linked to an anti-capitalist and anti-authoritarian perspective.